Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and won't be mentioning the Carabao Cup. I'm Kevin Day and he is Kieran Maguire on a one-hour loan deal from Liverpool University. Hello Kieran, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you Kevin. I saw my first live football match for 7 months last night and God, I just realised how much I love the game.
Who did you go and see?
It was Hassett versus Stenning in the Southern Combination. You turned up, you paid £6. It was, I mean, to be fair to the FA, they'd given a grant to the club so they could take the money using one of those little machines, so you know, no cash passing hands. And the linesman was wearing Sondico football boots, which took me back to the 1980s.
Nice. Was he one of those slightly podgy, overweight linesmen?
He was clearly there for the fee rather than the football.
Yeah, the sort of chap who 15 years ago thought he'd be in the Premier League by now and is instead running up and down hassocks and standing while you say sarcastic things at him. Kieran, it's Thursday, it's news day, and there's a lot of it, and quite a lot of it isn't good. So I want to start by way of a sorbet with a very good news story if you are a Wolves fan. And I'm quoting here from their official site, and they announced this yesterday. Wolves are proud to announce that they have their first testicle shaving partner.
Yes, and I thought that the partner would have probably gone for Forest instead of Wolves. But, it's good that this particular... And I worked on that one, Kevin. As you can imagine.
I should have told my face to react better, shouldn't I? I beg your pardon.
But this is actually following on from what we saw in the MLS a few months ago. And it is clear that sponsors are targeting particular demographics. And jesting aside, male testicular issues are very concerning. Men aren't testing them out enough. So... if you want to, if this encourages blokes to take a bit more concern over their crown jewels, because you don't want to get any nasty diseases, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, I imagine the Baroness probably responded in a similar way to Ali when I casually said, "Oh, Wolves have got an official shaving partner." She just don't even think about it. Now, our first story is a very bad one, if not. One that we didn't expect to have to talk about at some stage, because Amar Icardi has been playing brinkmanship with the future of Macclesfield Town for quite some time. And yesterday, he lost basically, but he didn't lose. The fans lost, didn't they? So the club was wound up in the High Court, but that's the end of it now. Is it Phoenix time?
Well, Macclesfield Town have been officially wound up in the High Court. They had debts of over £500,000. We said on more than one occasion that I think the EFL were anxious that if Macclesfield went bust, it wasn't on their watch. Mm. And effectively Macclesfield were relegated, sort of death of a thousand cuts, given the number of points deductions the club had last season. It's a tragedy for all concerned. And there's people who have lost their jobs. There's people in the back office. There's people who mow the grass. There's people who sell programs who get a few quid each time that they do this. But Macclesfield Town recruited 12 players over the summer before this winding up order took place. So it does appear that Mr. Icardi had managed to persuade some people that it was still full steam ahead.
That beggars belief, Kieran. That they're allowed to do that while this was hanging over them. But how could he convince? That's 12 players who probably would have been safe in the contract at other clubs, now out of a job and not likely to get any money. It's astonishing that happened, isn't it?
It is astonishing. I think there's desperate times for all concerned. Yeah, we know that 1,400 professional players were out of contract during the summer. So therefore, any contract is a contract. Remember that Macclesfield had hoped to get some form of reversal of some of their points deductions, but that clearly hadn't worked, and they were kicked out of the EFL. They had a brand new manager in Tim Flowers. You and I can remember him playing for Blackburn back in their glory days.
He went to school with Ali.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, as we never failed to remind him whenever Palace played a club he was playing for. Oh, look, there's your boyfriend. So you go, I just went to school with him.
And it's tragic news. What happens from here? Is a liquidator will be appointed, and the job of the liquidator is the first thing that they do is that they cancel all the employment contracts, so people are out of a job, and then they will look to sell the assets of the club. So that's going to presumably be the ground. Is there an opportunity for a Phoenix club? Well, yes, there is, but where are they going to start playing football? Because Moss Road or Moss Lane won't necessarily be sold for football. We don't know what the position is in terms of the offers made to the liquidator. But it's part of history and heritage. I've been to the ground. You've been to the ground. And it's another brick in the wall of football, which is being taken down one by one. The amount of money, which I think was owed to HMRC, was around about £500,000. Or in other words, 6/7 of Gareth Bale's pay packet for a week.
Yeah, I don't give a stuff about Amara Caldi, to be honest. But one of my favourite Match of the Day 2 trips was for an FA Cup game when Macclesfield travelled down to Chelsea. And I'm just thinking about those brilliant people I spent 4 hours on the coach with, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go with them. Some of the nicest, funniest people I've ever met, and their football club is gone. And it's just one of those. I think it's back in 1947 they became Macclesfield Town because the community contributed to saving them back then. And this is final, isn't it? There's no appeal. There's no back out. There's no way out of this. It's just gone.
If it's a High Court winding up order, I think they're dead. Yeah, it could. They've had so many last chances because This was scheduled for the 15th of June. They managed to get a 3-month stay of execution. HMRC have a job to do, on our behalf in terms of collecting taxes. So we can't blame the government. It's the people at the top of the club, Amar Al-Qadi, who by all accounts, he was never seen at the ground. He only used to sort of contact people by WhatsApp message. And clearly he'd lost interest. I think he'd been involved with the club since around about 2005. Mm. Macclesfield had been in and out of the EFL and the National League. It's a tragedy. And also for other clubs who are due to play them this season. They've now got mismatches in their planning. I know matches are taking place behind closed doors at present, but it just devalues the National League as the destruction of Bury and what happened to Bolton at the start of last season did with the EFL. I think the credibility of the game is suffering once more.
Well, on that note, the behind closed doors note, there is better news for some teams in League 1, League 2, because the government have given the go-ahead for pilot schemes to take place this weekend. Obviously not for clubs that are in areas where there's local lockdowns, but there will be people watching league football this weekend, which is something to be thankful for, isn't it? For the clubs in particular, obviously.
It is at relatively short notice, but short notice is better than not playing at all. My understanding is that clubs can apply to the EFL who have been working with the government, so you got to give them some credit there. The capacity is going to be limited to 1,000. I think it would have potentially been a wee bit higher, but because things in terms of COVID have deteriorated, the government has capped the limits lower than anticipated. Whether clubs will make any money with crowds of 1,000 is open to debate, because you're going to have to open up the turnstiles. You're going to have to have contact tracing. That you'll have to make sure that sanitisation is available. Certainly my experience at the non-league match last night was that everything was, if you went into the catering area, everything was in one direction, follow the arrows. It was quite a slow experience, but it was still football. I think everybody's hoping and praying that These are a success. I think clubs can apply to the EFL for to be granted as one of the pilot schemes. And if they're a success, then we can take things on a step further and further. Clearly, I think Daniel Levy sort of intimated if it's limited to 1,000 in the Premier League, then there's no point in opening up at a ground such as Spurs. So we'll have to wait to see what's happened when the government and the football authorities get round the table on the back of what happens this weekend.
And I know from listening to phone-ins, not just football phone-ins, but phone-ins on the radio, there are some people confused by fans being allowed back. They said, well, hang on, I can only meet five mates in a pub, but suddenly I'm allowed to go to a football game. And so you live down there in Leafy Sussex, Kieran. I live up here in concretey Norbury. And if you and I were to meet, I wouldn't go to Brighton in a million years unless I really, really had to. You wouldn't want to come to Croydon. So we might meet in Crawley, for example. We might say, let's go and meet in Crawley and watch Crawley play. Now, this time last week, we wouldn't be able to do that. But Crawley is effectively a suburb of Gatwick Airport. So we wouldn't be able to go to Gatwick Airport, but we would be able to get off a train at Gatwick Airport, go through some turnstiles, essentially, then go through some turnstiles at Gatwick Airport and queue up for hours to go through security, which are turnstiles again. And then we'd be allowed to get on a closed metal air box and fly. You know, you'd go to Dubai, I imagine, to buy some gold for the Baroness. So all those things are allowed to happen, but we wouldn't have been allowed to go. So it makes no sense. People go, well, we can only meet six people. But, you know, 1,000 people is a lot more than 30 people, which we could only meet last week. So it's the same as theatres. We've got to get people back in football grounds, especially at the lower level, because they thrive on match day income. And I know 1,000 is not enough. Gloucester Rugby Club, for example, have said we can't survive on 1,000 people. But 1,000 people is a start, and it's 1,000 more people than this time last weekend. So I just, you know, we hope and pray that it works, and fans have got their part to play in this as well, in acting responsibly when they can get into grounds. And the clubs are ready. I spoke to Phil Alexander, the CEO of Selhurst Park, last week. He said, you know, for the players, it's the safest place to be. And he said, well, we've made it that way for the fans as well on match day. They're ready to go, so let's go. It's a big day for Charlton today. It's a court hearing about the club ownership. We were due to speak to some of the Charlton, I was going to say agitators, but that is the right word, actually, some of the Charlton fans who have been campaigning. But it was decided that legally we probably shouldn't jeopardise any court hearing by being potentially controversial. What are the judges being asked to decide about Charlton Athletic, Kieran, and when will they do so?
Well, what has happened is that the present owners of Charlton Football Club, or Charlton Athletic Football Club Limited, which is a company called East Street Investments, has agreed to sell the club to a Danish gentleman called Thomas Sandgaard, who's based in the US. But previous to that, they'd agreed to sell the club to Paul Elliott, who's a businessman, as he describes himself, but he failed the EFL owners and directors test. He claims that he has invested significant sums in Charlton Athletic, and by doing so, he prevented them from going bust earlier this summer. Now, neither of us in a position to confirm or deny that particular issue. He says he's made his investments via a company called Lex Dominus Limited. I've looked at Lex Dominus's accounts. This is a company which has got £100 in a bank account. So, wow. You know, to invest substantial sums in Charlton Athletic seems a little bit strange. But what Paul Elliott has done is he's applied to the court for an injunction to prevent Thomas Sandgaard taking over the club, because he says that he's been unfairly treated in terms of the owners and directors test. He should therefore be allowed to buy the club. Thomas Sandgaard, he's posted that, and this is something which we've suggested ourselves in respect of deals, that he's put money into an escrow account, effectively somewhere where he can't get his hands on it. He's put in sufficient sums to cover the costs of running Charlton Athletic for the next 12 months as a goodwill gesture. So there's lots of finger pointing. In the meantime, Charlton can't effectively sign players because they don't know, they've got no money to do so. And things are taking place in courts where they should be taking place on the football field, just as we've seen in respect of Macclesfield Town. Southend United, they had a winding up order a few days ago, which has been kicked down the road again. There's far too much of this taking place in respect of football. I believe that Southend United are subject to a transfer embargo because they've not been paying the wages or not been paying some bills potentially. It's terribly messy. This should be a 15-20 minute podcast where we take the mickey out of people. And we turn up every week now, twice a week for an hour, and feeling like the Grim Reapers.
In the wider world of business, is this sort of dispute over ownership settled in court?
It can be, but remember, in most businesses, you don't have an owners and directors desk. So normally the first offer would be accepted when somebody was selling a company. Football is a unique industry, partly for good reasons, partly for not good reasons. And that's why increasingly it seems to be, the accountants and lawyers and how good your accountants and lawyers are, which becomes more important than your centre forward or the new goalkeeper or the new manager or whatever.
What's your instinct on the outcome of this?
I suspect that Paul Elliott won't succeed, but I think that this case could take a few days to resolve, which is delaying things in terms of recruitment. Remember, we're now only, two to three weeks away from the end of the transfer window, so it's making Lee Boyer's job that much more difficult, because until the ownership issues are resolved, then he can't do his job in terms of trying to put together the quality of the squad for the forthcoming season. So the football club loses, the fans lose, Lee Boyer loses, and so on.
Well, hopefully, as soon as the judge has made his announcement, we'll get those Charlton fans on the pod, and then there will be some piss-taking, Kieran. If you're missing the piss-taking, we'll get some Charlton fans on, and inevitably there will be some piss-taking. I may even mention the chap who threw a bolt at me once at a Charlton game and then assured me that he was throwing it towards me, not at me. But there's also a potential big day ahead, just a bit further along the Thames. I was going to say up, but I can't tell the difference between up and down the Thames, so we'll say along the Thames. A reported bid of £400 million for West Ham from an American consortium. Any details on that?
All we know is that Golden Sullivan have a fairly toxic relationship with the West Ham fan base. If you go to Karen Brady's website, they turned down an £800 million offer some time ago. And I suspect that they have been regretting that ever since, because it seemed... what were they buying? Because you're not buying London Stadium. That's owned by the council. So it's paper talk at present. There's no doubt. I think that they will sell for the right price. I think they've been a bit too starry eyed in the past. But as we've said, with in terms of the relationship between Golden Sullivan and the West Ham fan base, they took them away from the Bowling Ground, from Upton Park. And they made promises which they've not delivered on. The fans weren't over happy about it, because it is a fairly antiseptic walk to the ground. You and I have both gone as away fans to Upton Park, and it was proper football, atmosphere, great place to watch the game. And boy, was it noisy at times as well. What they've replaced it with is anodyne. And that's not a reflection on the fans. It's a reflection on the fact that it's an athletics track. Mm. So Golden Sullivan haven't upped the standards of what's happened, although they have spent money. I mean, again, it's a classic case of spending money but not spending money well. I believe one of the sons of the two owners, he's now in charge of the women's team or something of that nature. So there's a little bit too much nepotism. It's not how football should be run in a professional environment.
They have spent money in the past, but very little investment this summer, which I know got some alarm bells ringing from West Ham fans. And when the manager and the captain publicly fall out over not selling a player, it doesn't seem quite right at West Ham somewhere, and we'll keep an eye on that. Now, all of the Carabao Cup matches until the fifth round, which are not shown on TV, will be made available to stream. I did say we weren't mentioning the Carabao Cup, didn't I? But I reluctantly agree this is a news story. So, yes, if you so wish and your club is still in the Mickey Mouse tournament, you can stream it if it's not on telly.
Yes, so if you want to watch your team play in the Carabao Cup, and again, for your credit here to the EFL, they've managed to get streaming available, and you're going to be charged £10 per household, which is...
I'm not.
and that money is going to be split 50-50 between the home and the away team.
Right.
Having said that, there's going to be a broadcaster's rebate of £25 million because the two-leg semi-final, that's been converted into one leg. And also to compensate, I think, the broadcasters, i.e. Sky, for the fact that this alternative method of distribution is being used. So therefore, if perhaps the big match that was being broadcast live was, is it Lincoln City have got Liverpool in the next round? Well, you know, some fans might watch it, but now they might be watching their own team instead. So that's going to impact upon Sky's viewing figures. It looks as if that £25 million is going to be borne, though, just by Premier League clubs rather than the EFL clubs as well. So, that's fair play to them. The Carabao Cup is a funny one. There's, for what I can make out, there's no prize money in it until you get to the final. So the only money that clubs are going to be generating is going to be through this streaming. How successful that's going to be, we've got Portsmouth on Thursday night, for example, which I think is on Sky, but even if it wasn't, would I pay a tenner? It's difficult to get excited about it when the clubs themselves don't take the competition seriously. So if the clubs aren't going to do it, then why expect us to part with a tenner?
Now, our next news story, it says here, Premier League teams join the Carabao Cup this week. Producer guy really is taking the piss, isn't he? He really wants to hope that Palace don't beat Man United on Saturday because he's going to get a week of hell next week if we do. Why is it even a news story? Oh, hang on. Apparently, I'll tell you why. Apparently, the winners will enter a new European competition next season. Well, good for them. I hope they enjoy many a continental breakfast.
That's from the Vis Profanosaurus, actually. But I'll tell you the details of that continental after the show.
Is it one of your entries? I was going to say entries, but that would be wrong in the...
No, it's not.
Okay,
no.
All right.
This is the Europa Conference League. So it's absolute...
Who wants to be in that?
Yeah, can you imagine getting half and half scarf for that next year? and the reason for this is presently the Europa League has 48 clubs in it. So what UEFA are doing, and this is where I start to get a little bit twitchy, I think, is this the start of something more insidious? We're now going to have a Champions League of 32 clubs, a Europa League of 32 clubs, and a Conference League of 32 clubs. If you win the Conference League, you automatically qualify for the following year's Europa League. A bit like, right, if you win the Europa League, you then qualify for the Champions League. Now, the next big deal in European football is going to start in seasons 24 to 25. And that's where the potential for some form of promotion and relegation on a bigger scale, which could ring fence positions for the big clubs, could start to take place. So, my concern is here. Is this the start of such an environment? The winners of the Carabao Cup, they will only get into the preliminary rounds of the Conference League, and then from the preliminary rounds, you go into one of these daft group stages where you are playing the winners of the Albanian FA Cup on a Thursday night. Never mind having crowd limits of £1,000, whether you can engender sufficient interest to get 1,000 people to turn up, I think will be a challenge. It also means that if you finish seventh in the Premier League, Thursday nights could all of a change now.
It's gone quiet. So I presume we've stopped talking about the Carabao Cup, have we? Yes. I was just finishing off my third game of Noughts and Crosses. It wouldn't be a Thursday, Kieran, without Wigan or Derby in it. Derby fans, it's not you. Unfortunately, it's Wigan. And more unsettling news for Wigan fans.
It comes back to Wigan's former owners, IEC, the International Entertainment Corporation, who own hotels stroke casinos in the Philippines. Once again, I'm indebted to our Asia correspondent, Nigel Lee, the man that gives us all the hot news from Hong Kong.
Well,
and he spotted that this company, IEC, perhaps have revealed why they had to sell Wigan in the first place, but how they managed to find a sucker to buy the club is another matter. They've published a profits warning on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. They're anticipating losses of between 300 to 350 million Hong Kong dollars. So you divide that by 10 to convert it into sterling. But it does also say in this press release, which has gone to the stock exchange, that there are issues, there are problems in what they refer to as the disposal group, i.e. the football club, and they're unable to confirm some of the numbers involved. Effectively, because in order to do that, that they need to correspond with the Wigan administrators who are not cooperating. They've said, you know, our job is to focus on the sale of Wigan Football Club, and therefore, you know, we really couldn't give a stuff, even at £400 an hour, for helping you with your audit. So this means that IEC could go up before the Hong Kong Stock Exchange and get some form of penalty there. And frankly, they're welcome to it, because they're very strange background as to the sale of the club. You know, how they managed to persuade somebody to pay £41 million for the club is beyond me.
At some stage, when the Wigan saga is done and dusted, I think you and I and Nigel are going to have to sit down and do some proper investigating here, because like we said before, every time we mention Wigan, someone's got to bring this story to light and how it's allowed to happen, basically. And in an odd twist, and one with some sad nostalgia, there's another story about a previous owner, and a company run by the previous owner of Bury, Stuart Day, has published its administrator's report. Why is this significant?
Well, first of all, £438 an hour charged by the administrator. We are clearly in the wrong. But they do break that down. Apparently, they're now charged by the 6 minute, which there's sometimes when I've paid for things by an hour, and I wish I'd just paid for 6 minutes. But that's for another pod, of course. What happened here was that Bury Football Club apparently owed £7 million to this company called Medico. Or Medico owed £7 million to Bury Football Club. It's all very, very messy. Medico is the company run by Stuart Day, who was the previous owner of Bury Football Club.
Okay.
And he sold Bury Football Club for £1 to Steve Dale. Now, Medico went bust, and the administrators were selling off the debt. And it sold a £7 million debt to this is where it starts to get very, very sort of incestuous, to Steve Dale's daughter's boyfriend.
Holy shit.
And they sold a £7 million debt for 70 grand. And Steve Dale, he guaranteed that the 70 grand would be paid. So he paid the first instalment of 20 grand, one further instalment, and then he's not paid anything since. And now the administrators said, we don't think we can recover the money from him. But he used this to force through what's referred to as a creditor's voluntary arrangement at Bury Football Club, which has been called into question as to the legitimacy of some of the debts. So it's all legal, it's all messy, it's all proving to be very expensive. But unfortunately, you know, Steve Dale is playing the system as he's always played it. He said one of the reasons he can't pay these outstanding instalments is due to ill health. And every time that somebody points the finger at him, he says he's had cancer. Well, we don't wish any any illness or badness upon anybody. But how he seems to just use this as a prop whenever he's asked for money does seem very confusing.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Yeah, and I'm sure many of the people involved in this story are nice people. I'm sure the daughter and the boyfriend are lovely people, but these pricks are playing about with people's football clubs, and it's Newcastle United have brought out the proper big legal guns, Kieran, to represent them against the Premier League in relation to the recent failed takeover.
Yes, so this is litigation between the Premier League and Newcastle United. Now, Newcastle United are employing Blackstone Chambers, who are one of the top legal companies in the country, and they've gone for the number one man. They've gone for our friend Nick DeMarco, who is going to he has promised to come on the show one day when he's not too busy, when he doesn't have conflicts of interest in ongoing cases. He is a very smart guy, Nick. He represented QPR against the EFL, Sheffield Wednesday, Derby. He was the guy that got Stevenage off a points deduction for cancelling a match, which relegated Macclesfield, and Macclesfield are now. So, you know, everything is elbow to shoulder joint to everything's linked. But what's interesting for me here is that when I looked at the press release, this was saying it's to do with the Premier League rejecting the takeover of Newcastle United by PIF. Now, the Premier League have said, well, we've not rejected it. We've just not got round to making a decision. So it's all going to revolve around the owners and directors test. There's going to be expert witnesses. There's going to be thousands and thousands of documents taken. And I suspect it's going to be very, very expensive as well. So whether or not this could be used as a means of getting the PIF deal back on the table, and Mike Ashley does seem very keen for that to go through, is open to question, or whether he's just seeing his arse with the Premier League and is trying to get some compensation from them for preventing him from what he says is, you know, normal course of business.
Well, preventing him from making a lot of money as well, which is recent days, again, listening to phone-ins, football phone-ins, and going on to fans' forums, Newcastle fans are very upset about this, and Newcastle fans are very upset about people that are criticising Mike Ashley for taking this legal action. I can't blame them. I mean, I think it would have been fun to have the North East challenging the traditional power bases. But Newcastle fans use the word double standards a lot, and they're right as well. No one can take the moral high ground here about, you know, clubs being owned by regimes. You know, we've got clubs that have got Chinese involvement. We've got clubs that have got Abu Dhabi involvement. So it seems odd that the line in the stand was drawn at Newcastle United. So I don't blame them, because I think they're missing out. And I'd be interested. I'm glad to hear you say that one of the outcomes is a potential Saudi takeover still. I never thought I'd ever say
never
that.
Say never when it comes to business deals, is my experience.
All right, well, there's another potential takeover story at a lower level, but it's an interesting one, Kieran, in the context of many discussions we've had recently about fan ownership and how far up the league it can go. Wrexham are currently owned by the Supporters Trust, but they could be selling the club.
Yes, so this has they're presently effectively a Phoenix club, Wrexham. And I remember going to Wrexham for one of the Fans United days. And they were, you know, so hospitable. They were absolutely wonderful. They played Bristol City that day. And there were fans from every club. And, you know, this is one of the good things about football. But, you know, they were buying us drinks. They wanted to pay for us to go to pay our admission into the ground, because we've been going around with buckets for Fans United. They're presently owned by the Supporters Trust. They have been approached effectively to sell the club for a nominal sum to two individuals who are committing to investing £2 million into the club with a view to trying to get Wrexham back into the EFL, by increasing the playing budget. But I'm pleased to see that this is going to be done democratically. So there's going to be a meeting held with the fan base on the 22nd of September. People are going to be allowed to voice their opinions, and then, you know, some form of decision will be made. We've seen with both Portsmouth and Wycombe Wanderers, where they have been owned by supporters' trusts, and effectively they've gone back into private ownership. You know, being owned by a fan base, it isn't a silver bullet necessarily. You know, there are many good things. The likes of Motherwell and Exeter have done fantastic work within the community as well. So, we are certainly behind the concept of fan involvement. But there's a limit to, you know, how much fans can put in their pockets, especially at a time when clubs have got no money, which was partly why both Wycombe and Pompey were taken over themselves by private individuals. So, you know, there's a tough decision to make. Do you go with your heart or do you go with your head in respect of this particular one? And the people at the Supporters Trust have been very open and honest. Say, yeah, we do this out of love. If somebody more professional, or if somebody with a more of a business orientated background can devote more time to it, then we don't mind stepping aside. We want Wrexham AFC to be in existence in 10 or 20 years time, because it's a legacy issue far more than a, you know, I'm in control issue. So, you know, fair play to them for that.
I remember going there in 1983, I think it was. We won 1-0, and the Wrexham fans were very friendly then, I have to say, mainly reminding us how long it was going to take us to get home. and they were right. Now, the Premier League, Kieran, have rejected a request from the EFL for a share in Fulham's parachute money to distribute to clubs in lower divisions. Is there a precedent for this sort of request? What happens to parachute money when a club is promoted back?
There's no precedent. What has happened? Fulham were promoted to the Premier League. They came straight back down. That entitled them to 2 years of parachute payments. So they picked up £41 million in 2019-20, and they were entitled to a further £34 million in 2020-21. Now, because they went straight back up to the Premier League, we've now got this pot of money sitting round. According to the paperwork, according to the small print that I've read, that money then goes back to the Premier League and it's split evenly between the 20 clubs. So, yeah, that's worth about £1.7 million per club. So you can see why the Premier League clubs are thinking, well, we'd like to have that. The EFL, if this story is correct, they've gone to the Premier League and said, look, you know, unusual times, extenuating circumstances. But I think they're also trying to get the government on board. I think that the government is trying to strong-arm the Premier League into coming up with some form of assistance package for clubs further down the pyramid. So that has apparently been rejected by Richard Masters and the Premier League clubs, who rather have that money themselves. I think the EFL are saying our clubs are in greater need than yours. We'll have to wait and see.
Well, I think the EFL are probably right, aren't they? Juventus have announced big, big losses. Are these COVID-related?
Yes, they are. If you think that Juventus won Serie A last season, again, they were in the Champions League and they got to the knockout phase of that. And they just announced losses which are up 75% to €71 million, which is why they've been so quiet in the transfer market this summer. As have Barcelona, as have Real Madrid. And I've been doing quite a few shows for both Manchester United and Liverpool fans. And the first thing they say, well, why are we not spending loads of money? Well, you've got to have money to be able to spend it. This is a message which I think some fans are perhaps not taking on board. If the dominant club in Italian football is losing huge sums of money, then it's going to be the same case elsewhere. And Juventus's wage bill was down because they weren't paying as many bonuses for progression in the Champions League as the previous season. But even so, they've got big losses. Expect to see this across the whole of Europe as clubs start to publish their accounts over the next few months.
Let's take a trip down under here, and we haven't been to Australia for a while. a story that one Australian tabloid has called the A-League wage war. Australian clubs have, or at least threatened to, withhold 50% of players' wages. What's the story?
Well, and the A-League is, in fact, another heading from the Viz Profanosaurus. I'd recommend that to anybody for an explanation of some of the more obscure issues in life. This is quite similar to what we see happening in the US between franchise owners and players, which can often end in strike. So as a result of COVID, Australian A-League football clubs or soccer clubs, whatever you want to refer to them as, they have been losing money. Club owners have therefore tried to unilaterally force through 50% pay cuts, and the players are saying, well, that's not acceptable. So where this is going to lead, whether this is going to get referred to FIFA, and if so, well, I've God help them all, I'm not certain, but it is indicative of a very different approach taken to what we've seen here in England, where clubs have been sort of, you know, tickling players under the chin when it comes to wage cuts. And I think only Arsenal in the Premier League managed to get that through. But clearly the approach taken in Australia is different. I think it is more of a franchise-based system, and therefore club owners are more focused on the bottom line rather than winning trophies, whereas it's the alternative here in Europe. I think this could be a really interesting test case. If it does go through in Australia, no doubt there will be club owners in other countries saying, well, they've been able to do it. Let's see if we can force that through. Perhaps players also have to be realistic in terms of their wage demands. My understanding of the A-League, it's not particularly well remunerated to begin with. It's probably the equivalent of League Two. So therefore, to expect players to take 50% pay cuts, you can understand why they're reticent.
Now, I'm fairly certain, Kieran, in the depths of my memory from early pods that we did, although, as you know, I've got full-on COVID amnesia. I don't remember much before lockdown. But I'm fairly certain that, didn't you tell me once that Australian football used to be run centrally, basically, by the Australian FA, and then clubs became independent, essentially, in the last season or two and started making their own decisions?
I don't recall that conversation.
Oh, okay, fair enough. There's probably a way we might edit that out. Kieran, God, I don't think Guy, brother. Guy always, whenever I say that to Kieran, to Guy, we might like to drop that bit, it's got a bit fluffy. No, listeners like they like real life intruding. Well, you know, if you didn't like this bit of real life intruding, just let Guy know. Now, somewhere else we've not been to for a while is Ireland. Let's go to Ireland when this is over, Kieran. I'll take you to Donegal and you can take me to somewhere not quite as nice. A report of this. I mean, I'm nostalgic now. We've had Berry, now we've got the FAI. This is just like the old days. A report into the former head of Irish football, John Delaney, reveals he ran up expenses of nearly €1 million in 5 years. That's not bad going, is it?
That is, yeah. Well, and certainly on our Irish tour, and I'll take you to the farm which the family own. That's how I learned to milk cows, and also how to castrate pigs, which at the age of nine isn't what you expect when your mum says, we're taking you on a family holiday.
You've said some sinister things to me in our time together, but I'll take you to the farm is one of the most sinister things you've ever said to me. I'll make sure I let people know. I'm going to the farm with Kieran, just so you know, if I don't come back. And of course you can castrate pigs, Kieran. I'm amazed. I'm just going to tick that off my checklist that I've got here in my script. Yes, you can castrate pigs. I'll tell Ali that. She won't be surprised. So, €5 million in 5 years.
Yeah, this is on top of his salary. So he was paid a €360,000 salary. He was given a €462,000 exit package. And I'm always a bit suspicious on this because Sean Harvey, the former head of the EFL, who, if you talk to fans of Bury or Bolton or Macclesfield or any one of dozens of clubs in the EFL, probably don't have the greatest of memories of Sean Harvey. He got a £511,000 payoff. So it does appear to be a football administrator is very, very lucrative. But yeah, there's been an investigation into John Delaney and his credit card.
Oh.
He ran up 125,000 euros on his credit card, including 50,000 withdrawn in cash. Now, I'm sure Bobby Numbers, your accountant, he normally probably doesn't encourage things of that behaviour if you're trying to put those through against your tax returns. And then you start to find some of the things that John Delaney was involved with. The FAI, the Irish Football Association, paid £80,000 for his 50th birthday party. Now, he did give part of that back, but only a fraction. The Football Association of Ireland also paid John Delaney's girlfriend £95,000. And going into some of the small print, €1,000 for spa treatments. And I think we both know what we're talking about there, don't we, Kevin?
Yes. Well, I know what I think you're talking about. Never mind Bobby Numbers, by the way. Ali Day used to go absolutely ballistic if I ever took cash out on a credit card. She would go potty, which is one of the reasons why I have several gaps in my wallet as we speak. I actually put my Soho Theatre director's card in my wallet to make it look like I had more cash cards than I've actually got, which is one. We started, Kieran, by talking about testicle shaving, so it would have been a nice Zen round to finish on castrating pigs, but we have another little story, another little sorbet, if you like, by way of ending what's been quite a serious pod. If only we'd had a schoolboy pod back in 1974, Kieran, we definitely would have been covering this story, wouldn't we?
Yes, this is I think from the Yorkshire Evening Post in 1974, and it's just that people say to me, "Football finance never used to exist." Mm. Well, this is a letter from a very unhappy Bradford City fan who was complaining about the price of admission going up from 25 pence to 40 pence to watch a match, and the price of a programme doubling from 5 to 10 pence. And as he said in his final sentence to the letter to the local paper, "This means it's going to cost me an extra 20 pence a time to watch a football match, and for that they can go and stuff it."
Well, I mean, that would have been 2 pints, to be honest, at the time, probably, or at least a pint. So that's it. I like the fact that, well, there's always been, we know that, Kieran, there's always been corruption and skullduggery going on in football. So if anybody else has historical evidence about this, but feel free to send them in. As you know, my dad stopped going to Palace. We turned up one season, it had gone up to a fiver. And hello, what's upset the dog?
Oh, it's postman.
Is that because I mentioned Palace? You trained him. You trained him to start barking as I mentioned Palace. Oh, he is upset. Well, I think we'll save the amusing story of my dad not going in because it cost a fiver for another day. It is 1977. The dogs haven't barked at a postman since 1977, Kieran. What's going on?
Well, I live in a very historical town.
Yes, indeed. Okay, I'll do my message about questions. So if you want to ask questions for our next pod or any other pod, it's questions@priceoffootball.com, and I'll hand over to you, Kieran, to end this podcast.
Well, thanks again, folks, for your feedback. Thanks for your reviews on Apple Podcasts. If you could give that big purple button a bash and give us 5 stars, it doesn't matter what you say, apparently, according to producer guy. So you can say whatever you want about the pair of us. We've got thick skins. It's not in there for our ego. And if you want to subscribe as well, so you get the show as it comes out at 2 a.m. on a Monday and a Thursday, then please do so. But apart from that, look after yourselves, look after your testicles, guys, and we'll see you soon.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.